info@wpfw.org. Thanks.
Greetings. I'm Askia Muhammad, news director. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest this morning is Paul Nelson. Paul Nelson is co-founder of the Northwest Spoken Word Lab. He has been a radio broadcaster interviewing hundreds of authors, poets, and activists from 1980 to 2006. Nelson is the author of A Time Before Slaughter. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm very well, Ethelbert. Nice to be here with you.
Well, thank you for waking up very early. I want to begin by asking, what's going on in the Northwest these days? What are issues that you and other artists, in Washington State might be concerned about?
Well, obviously, the new administration is, facing a lot of resistance here. His first order, not the most recent one blocked last night, but the first one was blocked by a Seattle judge appointed by George W. Bush. I mean, it kind of tells you a lot in that one action. And we have a socialist city council member here in Seattle, Shama Sawant. In Seattle, the gentrification, the rising cost of home ownership and even rents is turning us into another version of San Francisco, where I heard that someone said they complained they couldn't get by on the $140,000 annual salary that they had. And, the housing issue here bubbles into homelessness and sweeps of homelessness camps and, feelings of the United States, the values of the U.S. not shared by people who live in this part of the world, in the bioregion called Cascadia.
And how have writers like yourself responded to this?
I mean, just yesterday was Ides of Trump, where there was an attempt to set a record of 1 million pieces of mail in one day to, let the new president know that we oppose just about everything he does. And I wrote two postcards. It fits in well with our August Poetry Postcard Fest we've been doing for 10 years. And, in other ways as well. And it's not just Trump. It's just a whole approach. Trump is just the far right or fascist edge of it, but it's a whole movement of neoliberalism that's been going on for 40 years that I address in poems all the time.
We've known each other for a long time, and I go back and I look at, you've always been active, and I wonder about your sense of optimism in the midst of all this sort of like darkness.
Well, I think ultimately things happen for a reason, and we wouldn't plan it this way, but very good things are happening. The indivisible movement, people responding by inundating Congress with phone calls. So I understand a Republican senator from Pennsylvania says they've never seen any kind of response like this, and it's sustained, and it goes on. And I get emails 2-3 times a day, phone numbers to call, scripts to follow, policies or proposed policies to oppose, and this kind of organizing, I'm certain, would not have happened had Hillary Clinton won the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Now let's go back, and Paul, and let's talk about how and why you created the Spoken Word Lab.
Well, I was living in Auburn, Washington at the time. It's a town 30 miles south of Seattle. I remember bringing you to it, and you said, oh, I get it. This is like Newark. I do remember that moment well. And it was like that, except that I don't think it ever had the kind of culture that Newark does, despite our attempts. And, there was an open mic that happened in town, and it folded, and I thought that every town deserves to have some kind of literary base. And so one time, standing in front of one of many abandoned storefronts in this old historic district, I said to Danica Dinsmore, if we opened up a place for poetry right here and worked with young people and had visiting poets from out of town and did that kind of, had workshops, what would you call it? And she thought for a second, and she said, the Northwest Spoken Word Lab. And eventually, we were able to that venue for a few years at $600 a month, and we brought many, many amazing poets to this little town 30 miles south of Seattle. My daughter, who now lives in Brooklyn, wrote a great piece for our 20th anniversary, talking about Seattle people who were kvetching that they had to go to Auburn for a cultural experience.
I know that while you were there, you've done a tremendous job in terms of just interviewing writers. What's been happening with some of those documents?
I have a manuscript called American Prophets, and my goal would be that the book of my A-list interviews gets published in time for our 25th anniversary of the nonprofit, which the 25th anniversary will be on in December of next year. So there's some very, very good interviews, including people like Allen Ginsberg and Wanda Coleman and Nate Mackey and other really, really important American poets, and other people too, indigenous people, and authors like Gene Houston and Rupert Sheldrake and folks like that. So I'm hoping it'll be published by the end of next year.
Good. I know later this year, I think from July 13th to the 16th, you'll have the Cascadia Festival. Talk about that.
Well, the fest is going to happen in October in Tacoma.
Oh, so it's not going to be in July? It's going to be in...
No, October 12th through the 15th. Okay. We're actually going to be doing a couple of different iterations. One will be in Cumberland, British Columbia in September. And
you're not doing anything in Granite Falls?
No, I'd love to be in Granite Falls. There's a Shinto shrine there, but right now, we don't have. We'll be lucky we get the funding for the two that we're trying to pull off.
Right, I understand that. Okay.
Well, bioregionalism, as defined by Peter Berg, and Cascadia as defined by David McCloskey. These people, Peter Berg has passed. Another gentleman. I've interviewed both those gentlemen. Peter Berg created the Planet Drum Foundation. And, it's a way of being in the world sustainably. It's a way of looking at where you live as a country whose borders would have been created by nature. So, in other words, no straight lines that cut through watersheds, and base it on geology and geography. And Cascadia extends from Cape Mendocino, California, to Mount Logan, Alaska, and generally from the Continental Divide on up. And, this part of the world, it tends to be a little less religious, spiritual but not religious, I think. It tends to be, has a lot more nature. There's still a lot of wilderness left compared to other parts of the continent. And tends to be a little more influenced by Asian culture than European culture. Certainly it was settled by the descendants of Europeans, but as Rex Roth said, the West Coast looks towards Asia rather than towards Europe. So these are some of the things I'm tracking in my 20-year bioregional cultural investigation. And, of course, the influence of water. We know this month, since we've already had our average rainfall for March in the first 2 weeks of the month.
Right. Well, look, one person whose work has had a significant influence in your life was Charles Olson. Talk about Olson's importance to American poetry. We know Olson was born in 1910, died in 1970. We know him for his Maximus poem. But what was his influence on your life?
Well, I came to his work through Michael McClure, who, when I interviewed him in 1995, yet there's another interview which, changes the direction of my life, McClure in 1995. He said, if you like what I do, it's because you like projector verse. And get this essay, read it out loud, because it tends to be difficult. And I did. I read projective verse. In fact, I taped it when I was working for the jazz station on the overnight show. I would go in between records and read a paragraph or two, and then listen to my recording of projective verse over and over and over and over until I internalized it. And Olson, that he was a working class intellectual, was really interesting to me and a model for me in that way. That he really understood, I think, spontaneous composition. It's sort of like a bebop version of poetry. You practice, 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 and then in the moment you get it as close as possible. And there's a great line from the essay, a use of speech at its least careless and least logical.
How does that connect to abstract expressionism and jazz?
Well, it's the moment of composition. Abstract expressionism is you are in the painting, and what happens in that moment is really critical, and you live or die with it. And the same thing with bebop. especially, I would say, the more outside versions of jazz, like people like Fred Anderson and the AACM and people like that, who not only improvise, they don't improvise from a tune, but they improvise complete sets of music that, in its best, is transcendent. It's a religious or spiritual experience. And that's a really fascinating experience to have as a writer, to be in the moment and to see something come through you. I remember seeing Fred Anderson with Hummy Drake and William Parker, and I came up to Hummy Drake after the show, and I said, "Man, that was amazing." And he said, "It wasn't me, it was the Holy Ghost." And I think that's an interesting way of realizing a certain modesty, realizing that the source of the poem or the source of the tune or the source of the painting is outside of you, and having the humility to be able to trust that.
Well, let me ask you this, Paul. This is like a sort of very personal question. You're saying that. What's happened to you spiritually for you to be receptive to these ideas?
Well, Olson in the essay Project a Verse said, if a man have a humilitas sufficient to make him abuse. And I think that as you practice writing poetry spontaneously, it's a path towards liberation. And it also opens up connections that can deepen other ways to connect to spirit. And I've been a longtime Subud member now for 13 years, a spiritual community that's around the world, but very, very small. It was started in Indonesia. I've been doing yoga for 25 years. Some months my practice is better than others, but I have that practice. I draw a rune every day. And, it's deepened my, the one thing it's done is deepened my understanding that there is a divine plan for my life. And the more I can track this, the happier I am, and the more successful I am. There was a woman, an author, Carolyn Mace, who said, "You ever get that little, voice in your head that says, do the dishes or clean the cat box, and you either ignore it or you don't?" Well, she said, "Well, that's God speaking. And if you're getting training here, if you don't hear the little messages, how are you going to hear the big message? Go start an orphanage in Africa." you have to start with the little things.
Well, look at this, Paul. When you say that, right, and I look across the country and I see many people in creative writing program, it doesn't seem like they're going to get this advice. I mean, I don't know how you would workshop what you just said.
Well, I think the key in the workshops when I've done them is to allow people to have the experience of spontaneity. That's the reason we started the Postcard Fest, the August Poetry Postcard Fest, where you get on a list with 31 other people, and you agree to write a poem spontaneously on a postcard and send it to the next person on the list, and agree to do 31 in the month of August. And we've since extended it, so you can start it as soon as you get your list, which could be as early as July 5th. That's why we're calling the anthology that's coming out this year the 56 Days of August. And, it's hard to do that. It's hard to sit down and trust that what you write is going to be decent. And when it's going only to one person, the stakes are very low. So to start out that way and to write 31 of them in a short period of time, by the end of them, you're starting to get some facility. You're starting to shut out the editor's mind and trust that you can come up with something halfway decent. And if you fail, it's okay. You learn from that.
Let's go back to Charles Olson, because I think you might have mentioned this in passing. He's a difficult writer. Would you agree?
Yeah.
How do you approach his work?
Well, poets like Olson or Brenda Hillman or Nate Mackey or Joanne Kiger, I think these people who generally write spontaneously, it's not an instant in. If you want something you're going to get the first time, stick with Mary Oliver, But if you want something that has a higher degree of difficulty and then, I think, a higher payoff, you could read the Maximus poems every 5 years and get something new out of it, because there's such depth to it. So it's like these kinds of writers, there's a certain amount of time that you have to spend to attempt to figure out how their mind works before you fall into their work. I remember starting with Nate Mackey, and I'm like, oh my God, how do I get into this? And then the second book I read of his, much easier, and the third book I read of his, it was like I had some sense of how his mind worked. So I didn't have to negotiate that hurdle. I was already allowed entry because of some of the work that I've done to show respect for the intense and deep work that he's done.
Okay, I'm going to go back in time. I was introduced to Olson's work by way of the New American Poetry Anthology edited by Donald Allen, which came out around 1960. Charles Olson is actually the first writer in this book. He has about 10 poems. In the back of this book, in section 4, there's statements on poetics, and you find Charles Olson's projected verse. There's also correspondence there with Robert Creeley. Did you encounter Robert Creeley's work? Was that important to you? Because there's a lot of correspondence between Creeley and Olson as they work out their ideas.
Yeah, Creeley is less important to me than a lot of other poets, especially around projective verse, or you can call them the Black Mountain poets.
Mm-hmm, the North Carolina.
Yeah, the experimental college that went from the 20s to the 50s and has an amazing history. So Creeley, not as important. It's not the same affinity that with Olson or McClure or Ginsberg or people like that.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to look at, in this book, and I'll get you to respond to this, in the back of this book with the poetics, there's an essay by Leroy Jones, Mary Baraka, How You Sound. And I want you to respond to two lines that he has in this short essay. The first is, there cannot be closet poetry unless the closet be wide as God's eye. There cannot be closet poetry unless the closet be wide as God's eye.
Yeah, well, I immediately think of Emily Dickinson, you know, and I immediately think of that Auden statement that poetry does nothing, and then people don't get the next line of that of that Auden statement, and they use it to justify that poetry doesn't do anything in the world. It has an effect. It has an effect on the person, and I think that's the joy of writing spontaneously, is to see what comes through you, and there is a connection to the divine. Mm-hmm. And Olson in Projective Verse says, you know, the verse will change, and the person will change if you do it that way, and I think he recognized that, and I also think that he was a little afraid of using words like God or spirituality, so he used a phrase called the single intelligence, and I think that's what Baraka is after too.
Mm-hmm. Let me read you this other line by Baraka. The only recognizable tradition a poet need follow is himself.
Yeah, I think that's true. That reminds me of my Igbo friend who said an Igbo proverb is, every man, you could say every person, is a religion.
Mm-hmm. So
I would say that, and I think McClure's line, the way to the personal, the way to the universal is by means of the most intensely personal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to just bring in one more other person who's in this New American Poetry Anthology and have this the female voice, which is sometimes missing from the beat movement. And in this anthology, there's not that many women included, but there is Denise Levertov. And I just want to read this to you, Paul, and get your response. She writes, I believe poets are instruments on which the power of poetry plays. But they are also makers, craftsmen. It is given to the seer to see, but it is then his responsibility to communicate what he sees, that they who cannot see may see, since we are members one of another. I believe every space and comma is a living part of the poem and has its function, just as every muscle and pore of the body has its function. And the way the lines are broken is a functioning part essential to the poem's life. I believe content determines form, and yet that content is discovered only in form. Like everything living, it is a mystery. The revelation of form itself can be a deep joy, yet I think form as means should never obtrude, whether from intention or carelessness, between the reader and the essential force of the poem. It must be so fused with that force. I do not believe that a violent imitation of the horrors of our times is a concern of poetry. Horrors are taken for granted. Disorder is ordinary. People in general take more and more in their stride. Hides grow thicker. I long for poems of an inner harmony in utter contrast to the chaos in which they exist. Insofar as poetry has a social function, is to awaken sleepers by other means than shock. I think of Robert Duncan and Robert Creeley as the chief poets among my contemporaries. Denise Levertov wrote that in 1959. How do you respond to that, Paul?
Well, I mean, you know, she's absolutely right, I think.
And, we should awaken, you know, the sleepers.
Absolutely. It's, well, and not, and those mildly asleep and those open to the possibility of a deeper experience with life. And, you know, Levertov lived the last 8 years of her life about, you know, 2,500 steps from where I am right now. We put a plaque up last year to honor that fact. And she, more than any other person of that era, understood the spontaneous gesture. And her essays, Some Notes on Organic Form and The Function of the Line, are critical and stand up incredibly well after 50 or whatever years that it's been. Mm-hmm. And Levertov is a very, very important poet. And you know, you said something about the beat and a lack of women being involved. I remember Gregory Corso responding to that, saying that women who were connected with the Beats were, you know, treated like they were crazy people. They were, you know, subject to an incredible amount of criticism. It was a very difficult thing for a woman to be involved in that way. So to liken it to something that was against women or misogynistic, I think is inaccurate. Yeah. And, I mean, certainly there's the sort of gay male component of a lot of writing communities that may have feelings of being against women. But, you know, I look at McClure's work, for instance, as a beat poet. And, of course, you can talk about people like Joanne Kiger and Diane DePrima, mm-hmm. Two poets who are, you know, still alive, and Kiger writing some of the best work of her life. So I would be hesitant to knock the Beats for being anti-woman. It was just tough mm-hmm. for especially women to be involved in a movement like that back in the 50s.
Let's also talk about what happens. I mean, sometimes we can look at this two beat movements. You talk about McClure. He would probably be more associated with what we would call the San Francisco Renaissance, right?
Yeah, I think that's accurate, and I think more of a Black Mountain poet.
Mm-hmm. What's the?
I wrote an essay that I presented in Brussels, saying that projective verse was going to be the spiritual legacy of the beat movement, and McClure's use specifically of projective verse is probably the highest accomplishment of any of the writers associated with the Beats. Mm-hmm.
Let's look at going back to you, Paul, and here you are in the Northwest. When we look at American poetry, do we find that sometimes that when we look at our literature and maybe how it's taught across the country, that certain regions just get overlooked?
Well, I think there's no question that there's an East Coast bias. I mean, we see that in sometimes it has to do with the time change. You know, how many poets are going to get up at 5 in the morning to talk to Albert on telephone?
Well, that's why you have Starbucks.
You know, in fact, the Starbucks does open across the street at 5 a.m., so I could have probably pulled that off.
So they do close.
Yeah. You know, and when you look at Cascadia as a bioregion, this extends into British Columbia and to the Alaska Panhandle, and if you think the poets don't care around the country about people from Seattle, imagine how they treat poets from Canada. I mean, this is like, you know, the bastard stepchild of North American literature. And yet, in the Canadian psyche, it seems to be a built-in genuine humility. And I have to tell you, Ethelbert, that's refreshing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a force that is found in genuine humility. And the more and more I read Canadian poets, the more I think they're really onto something. People like George Bowring and Daphne Marlatt and Sarah DeLayu and Stephen Collis. He's a story all in himself. And the interview I did with him about 10 days ago is incredible, how he, you know, attempted to blockade a pipeline's construction. And he was sued for $5.7 million by Kinder Morgan, and they used his writings against him in court. And then he published the transcript in a book of poetry. So that's inventive, and it shows commitment, and it also shows the vision that we got to leave this stuff on the ground.
Have you followed some of the Alaskan writers like Peggy Shoemaker, Haynes, and others? Have you been in touch with them?
I have not. Jeremy Pataki is one Alaska writer who we published in the Cascadia anthology that we did, Make It True. But that's a frontier that I have not yet gotten to. So it's on my list.
And when I think about where you are, I think of one African-American poet that sometimes I feel, you know, we need to talk more about on the East Coast. That's Colleen McElroy.
without question, here's a person who has not, I think, gotten the credit that she's due. And she is an elder, and I had a chance to interview her a year ago. You know, the one word that comes to mind when you talk about Colleen McElroy is Duende. Mm-hmm. You know, you can talk about Duende as a concept, but this woman, you know, she exudes it. Lorca talked about Duende as being a force so powerful that it was more like, not like petitioning a benevolent muse, but like wrestling with demons. And this woman has wrestled with them and has come out on top and continues to write, you know, the best work of her life. And it's just a real honor.
Has she been honored out there in any way, you know, like a day or, you know, a conference or anything to examine her body of work?
No, she hasn't. Not to my knowledge. And we had her at the last Cascadia Poetry Festival. And, you know, people were remarking just her presence is like a poem that awakens the sleeper. And I hope that she'll continue to do performances and be able to get some of the credit that she is due. I think she's one of those poets, unfortunately, who people are going to realize her power after she's gone, and I hope that's not for a while, because she's a real jewel to have here in the Northwest.
Yeah, when you say that, I went after some of her poems, but I also think that recently, you know, we lost African-American poet Mary Evans, who I thought was also another person, you know, maybe because of geography, you know, and being in Indiana, we know Nikki Giovanni and Sonia Sanchez before we know Mary Evans. But I feel that, you know, when we look across the country, there's so many wonderful writers, you know, whose lives need to be celebrated. I'm going to take a little break, Paul Nelson, and I'm going to come back and so that we don't overlook you, we're going to listen to your poetry. The station is WPFW. The show is On the Margin.
Hi, I'm Michelle, and this is your WPFW Social Justice Calendar for the Washington metro area. Thursday, March 16th, come for a viewing and discussion of the film Death in Geneva, The Poisoning of Felix Moumi, about France's dirty war in Cameroon, the assassination of its independence fighter called Cameron's Lumumba, followed by a discussion of contemporary resistance in the country, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Institute for Policy Studies, 1301 Connecticut Avenue Northwest, 6th floor. Please RSVP at ips-dc.org/events or call 202-787-5229. Friday, March 17th, United Black Community presents the Home in Africa Forum about the Songhai Agro-Environmental Centers flourishing in Benin, West Africa, and spreading throughout the continent. Presented by Dr. Ur Awa, Ehimetu and Kamet, 7:30 p.m. at the Emoja House, 2015 Bunker Hill Road, Northeast D.C. Products from Songhai will be available for purchase. For more information, call 202-526-4039 or email ubcindc@yahoo.com. Saturday, March 18th, Lambda Kappa Mu Sorority Incorporated, Theta Chapter, hosts a screening and discussion of the film Human Zoo, by Mondo Webb, a short film about a day in the life of an African girl on display for the first time in a human zoo in 1958. 2 p.m. at People's Congregational United Church of Christ, 4704 13th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. All this week until Sunday, March 19th, Africa World Now Project, Africa Fay, and AFI present the 13th Annual New African Film Festival, showcasing the vibrancy of African filmmaking from all corners of the continent, at AFI, Silver Theater, and Cultural Center, 8633 Colesville Road, Silver Spring, Maryland. For more information, call 301-495-6720 or visit afi.com/silver. Also Sunday, March 19th, the Liberation School presents Part 3 of Dezombification, a session to provide the tools for eliminating the effects of oppression and overcoming the subconscious programming that affects our daily lives. 3 until 6:30 p.m. at the Empowerment Center, 6490 Landover Road, Cheverly, Maryland. For more information, call 240-355-6962 or email liberatedmind@yahoo.com. Tickets are available on eventbrite.com. For an online listing of these events, or if you'd like your social justice event included in the social justice calendar, visit the webpage ips-dc.org/social-justice-calendar, where you will find submission guidelines. The Social Justice Calendar is a public service brought to you by the Institute for Policy Studies in partnership with WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
Okay, we're back on the margin. My guest today is Paul Nelson. Paul Nelson is co-founder of the Northwest Spoken Word Lab. He's been a radio broadcaster interviewing hundreds of authors, poets, and activists from 1980 to 2006. Paul Nelson is the author of A Time Before Slaughter. Paul, let's hear a few excerpts from your book. This is about Auburn, Washington, which is Slaughter's other name. I wanted you to read like the second part of A Time Before Slaughter.
Sure. Part two.
Begin to talk about, you know, this long poem and this book.
It's the first book in what I envision as a series of books of a serial poem that reenacts the history of Cascadia, this bioregion. And I lived in Auburn, Washington for 17 and a half years, and Auburn was originally called Slaughter, named after a lieutenant who died in the so-called Indian Wars, Lieutenant William Alloway Slaughter, and his story is told. And, you know, this notion of slaughter as a method of operation, not just a man, not just a town, but a way of doing business. I think we see that brought to its logical conclusion with the current presidential administration. So this second part is the first salvo in trying to connect with and tell the story of the experience of Americans of Japanese heritage, American citizens largely of Japanese heritage. So it goes like this, too. Slaughter is Executive Order 9066 and trains full with Nisei exiles and army escorts headed to Pinedale near Fresno, Friday, May 8, 1942, and more away on Mother's Day. 1,000 more on May 15, 1015, over two-thirds, 684, American citizens. Slaughter continues. While the slaughter powers that be hosted a dance for the troops of the VFW, men well-fed, slaughter is patriotic. By May 22, the last train left. Sympathetic neighbors with cookies, cakes, candies, and rides. Like we were going on a real picnic, says Mei Isiri Yamada. One white girl wanted to go along. Mei and Frank Natsuhara returned. Most didn't. The store survived. Most of the land lost, divvied up, sold cheap. Slaughter is the view of cherry trees one last time from prison trains bound for California.
You know,
slaughter is the roar of the stuck at sunset on overcast August Sunday. Three ducks nestled amidst the rocks of the milky August stuck. The prop plane whirr, cutting through the August clear blue morning sky while sunlight streams through yoga windows. Slaughter continues.
You know, Paul, when you read that and you think of just what's going on now, you know, that May 22nd, the last train left, you know, the sympathetic neighbors with cookies, cakes, and candies and rides. You know, it just makes you stop, you know. You know, I just found this introduction to the overall long serial poem, to be very moving. Talk about the serial poem, Paul. You know, when I look at what you've done here with Slaughter, I think of William Carlos Williams and what he's doing with, you know, what he did with Patterson.
Yeah, I think that that Williams and Olson specifically were starting to chisel around the edges of what would be called a, you know, serial form seriality. Sam Hamill calls it the sequential poem, and it really I think took off on the West Coast with people like Robert Duncan, whose passages and structure of rhyme were two threads that wove through his work. And were his seriality, which really influenced Nate Mackey, whose ongoing serial poem, 30 years now, also has two strands that weave through Mu and Song of the Andumbulu. And Mackey, when I interviewed him a few years ago, said his appeal, the appeal of the serial form to him, is that the fact that things remain open. It's an open form. And quoting from the interview, the transcript, he said, "The well-wrought urn aesthetic, where the poem is this discrete, self-contained accomplishment in which everything fits together and works together in this well-oiled, machine-like way, imposes a certain sense of closure on each poem that I find constricting and found constricting." Mm-hmm. And so I think the serial form, the beauty of it for me is that it's about as open as you can get in a gesture in literature.
You know, now when you mentioned Nate Mackey, we know that Nathaniel Mackey's also drawing from like Don Cherry's music, also Glenn Spearman, you know, musician. When you're doing your work, is any form of music coming into it?
Well, without question, you know, I was working at a jazz station while I was still in college in Chicago, working with Daddy O'Daly. Does that name ring a bell?
Daddy O'Daly, okay.
Daddy O'Daly was the guy for whom Cannonball Adderley wrote the song "One for Daddy-O" on his Something Else record.
Mercy, mercy,
so
mercy.
A legendary, legendary Chicago jazz mm-hmm. DJ. And I was listening to jazz and working at a jazz station while I was still in my, I think I was 18 years old when I started there. So music has been a huge part of my life. And yeah, there are forces that come through. And, you know, I give thanks that my mother was born in Cuba, so mm-hmm. I have an appreciation for polyrhythm and mm-hmm. For the kind of jab steps that we can take, whether we're dancing, playing music, or writing poems. And I think I'm very blessed to have a good ear and a musicality in my work that I think is expressed best through assonance and rhythm that yes, it owes all kinds of props mm-hmm. to jazz, and you know, not just bebop, but bands like Weather Report, who you know,
and
people like Jaco Pastorius and Wayne Shorter and Joe Zawinul, so Weather Report and influence music a huge influence. And I'll say one more thing about the thing that that Mackey relates. You know, you talk about projective verse or organic poetry, or as Jack Spicer and Robin Blazer called it, the practice of outside. Well, Mackey loves that because of outside jazz, like you said, mm-hmm. Don Cherry or AACM or Cecil mm-hmm. Taylor or any number of people that he will link on his Facebook page when it's their birthday. He loves that the practice of outside would also connote outside jazz. And
I remember this is a number of years ago. Nathaniel Mackey was a writer in residence at the old WPA here in Washington, D.C. I think he was brought here by Jock Reynolds. And, you know, I went down there to see him. In fact, that might have been the first time I met Mackey. And I said, "Mackey, you got to come up to Howard University. I want you to see something that I think echoes your work." And I took him up to Howard University. We went into the gallery, and the sculptor, Ed Love, had a show. And I remember Nathaniel Mackey standing in the doorway looking at Ed Love's work and said, like, "This is what I'm trying to say." And I remember, like, a few months later, on the cover of his magazine, Hambone, he had Ed Love's sculpture. You know, it seems as if here was another way the writers looking not just to music, but also to the visual arts, to sculpture.
And you know, that Mackey would be open and that his own soul would swirl that out and have it return in that way. Einstein said that coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. And that's the beauty of being open. That's the beauty of negative capability, as Keats called it back in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. It's that ability to not to come to conclusions, to, you know, to be able to respond to the dictates of the moment without any preordained plan. It's the essence of spontaneity, you know.
We're not gonna be spontaneous right now, but because I want you to read How the Whales Reach the Sea. I have a script here.
I understand, and I will stick with it if you want me to read to the next one. How the Whales Reach the Sea is, I think, what you got
exactly.
Planned.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is text that was found. Text that is from a book of stories that were gathered by Arthur Ballard, who spoke the local language because he had a Muckleshoot nanny. Muckleshoot is one of the tribes out here in Auburn. And this is taken from an informer, so a Muckleshoot person, and it's a story. So it's one of the myths of this place, and it's How the Whales Reach the Sea, first version. A long time ago, in the valley between what is now Sumner and Renton Junction, was a vast lake. The course of the Puyallup River followed what is now known as Wapato Creek. In the lake, there used to be two whales. There they made their home. Upon the point of the hill northwest of Sumner, now blasted away to give room for the Tacoma Highway, there used to stand a huge boulder. To this spot, the people would go to get a view of the country above the impenetrable forest. From this point, they could see the whales disporting themselves in the lake. One day, however, children from the village noticed the whales acting strangely and reported the strange actions to their elders. The whales had become tired of their restricted range in the inland lake and were thrashing about and churning the waters mightily in their effort to make their way out. Finally, on the fourth day, they plowed into the land and forced their way through, opening a way through the plain out to the sound. The water followed them down the channel, and thus a new river came into being. We call that river Stex, which means plowed through. The whites call it Stuck River. Most of the water in the lake drained out through the new channel. What used to be the main river now became just a small creek, Wapato Creek. Where the lake used to be is now a level valley.
You're listening to Paul Nelson reading from his book, A Time Before Slaughter. Let's continue, and if you could read Praise 2, which I really like.
Okay, this is going to the Stuck River, that same river that was plowed through and was dynamited by settlers several times. They actually blew it up to change its course, which is another poem in the book. And I used to go to the river to after dropping off my older daughter at her middle school. Praise to the river, whose beaches accept full moon agonized howls, whose grassy banks make soft nests for November naps, whose rocks have seen a thousand wailing pilgrims, whose water comes from the giant sacred mountain, whose cliffs accept daily task of welcoming the dawn. Praise to the river, whose water the dog laps up and cools August heat in, whose course has been exploded, diverted by changes and struggle, whose power provides a worthy model, whose midnight ripples reflect November moonlight, who demarcates our home. Praise to the river, whose course was plowed by whales, whose soul is ancient and healing, whose waters the blood that spawns salmon and welcomes their annual star-guided return home. Praise to the river, whose might is trapped by Mud Mountain Dam, whose scotch broom mimics the sun's gold in May, whose berries feed Russians, whose trails seen a thousand seeking souls, whose rapids provide the roar restores the slaughter calm. Praise to the river, which slakes our thirst without complaint and reminds us what it is to flow.
Oh, thank you, Paul Nelson. You know, one, if one looks at this book, you know, very quickly, if you're just in a store or a library, you picked it up, one immediately notices a variety in terms of, you know, how you handle visual, you know, white space on the page, the various line breaks, the length of stanzas. It seems as if I was listening to this book, it would have all those various sounds and nuances.
Yeah, well, going back to projective verse, Olson talking about how the typewriter allows the poet to make the poem on the page a score. And I think that training yourself to listen to how it would sound how it would look on the page is part of that spiritual discipline that one develops as a projective poet. And George Bowring said in a note on happiness that was published in the Vancouver Sun, when a poem has you in its grip, you've got to shut up your usual yapping and listen as hard as you can. And if it continues to work and nothing interrupts it, you will get to be the first reader of the poem. It will be a happy event.
Mm-hmm.
And so looking at yourself as the first reader of a poem that you actually wrote is a way of flipping it so that people understand what this experience is. It's the received poem.
Well, you made a number of references to Wanda Coleman during our show today, and I want to bring her voice in and so that people can hear the poetry of Wanda Coleman reading her poem, Drums Inside Your Chest.
Every death, a haunting, deep sleep of word, lives pass and overlap their cadence a farewell, dreamlessly streaming in slumber, in rising. Feet glow and drop to the floor, blooms taking root, becoming limbs, climbing after light. It is fashionable to rhyme, to adorn sound with pain, content with manner, to spitefully whisper in Spencerian ink or Shakespearean blush. It is passé to slip into paper, wear parchment's timber, stained saffron and rose with splendors overflow. Cross-legged, the poet, dripping moon, from spirit torn collects. She collects the leavings of her pillow and pins her book of stone.
That was the poetry of Wanda Coleman. Paul, you did something which I really admire you for. Wanda Coleman died back in 2013, but when she was ill, you were one of the people who really came to her aid in terms of, you know, trying to raise money. Talk about Wanda Coleman, the person that you knew, and also I know that you like her American sonnets.
You know, yeah, it's a tough one, and when you hear the poem that you just played, you know, references to death, they sound prophetic, you know, and I would never want to be a person who would cross Wanda Coleman alive or dead. I would not want to mess with this person, and you know, I just know that she had a lot of pain in her life, and yet she was able to transmute that into incredible work, like the piece that you read, and then also just this incredible dynamic performance sense, which really brings the poems alive. She's got a poem in her American Sonnets, the 12th one in that series. It's just a 15-line poem. I have it here, written after Robert Duncan. So is it okay if I just
go ahead
and read this?
Go ahead, Paul.
My earliest dreams linger, wronged spirits who will not rest. Dusky crows astride the sweetbriar seek to fly the orchard sky. Is this the world I loved? Groves of perfect oranges and streets of stars where the sad eyes of my youth wander the atomic age paradise, tasting the blood of a stark and wounded puberty? Oh, what years ago? What rapture lost in white heat of skin, walls that patina my heart's despair? What fear disturbs my quiet night's grazing, stampedes my soul? O memory, I sweat the eternal weight of graves. Hmm. You know, you talk about duende. There's another person with whom, you know, she walks in the room and you feel the duende.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you, you know, we look at Wanda Coleman and we, you know, we can't separate Los Angeles from Wanda Coleman, and I look at you and we can't separate, like, Auburn, you know, Washington from you. The whole thing of the importance of place for writers, you know, that we, take time not just to live in a place, but to write about it and to study its history.
Well, you have to be grounded to be any success, you know, to be any good to yourself as a human. And I think that's one of the biggest problems we have right now. There's, you know, we've lost the groundedness. You know, my folks live in Chicago. I grew up in Chicago. I laid down roots in Auburn, never felt really accepted there, and moved to Seattle 6 weeks after my daughter graduated from high school, you know, and you have to be connected to place. It's just part of what you really have to do to, you know, to be a whole human. You have to understand where you are. And I think Gary Snyder and his understanding of bioregionalism is a real good guide for that. Know the names of the plants. Know the names of the animals. Know where your water comes from. We've lost that as a species here in North America by and large, and we will need to rediscover it, or Trump is the left wing of what's to come.
You know, when you say that, one writer that I think of, you know, who's still living is Robert Bly. You know, it seemed as if what you say there, you know, we're talking about writers like him. We're also talking about, you know, Wendell Berry. We're talking about, you know, people who, I guess, would trace us back to Whitman.
Yeah, well, as you said to me in our interview, aren't we all children of Whitman? And that was brilliant. I mean, that's a teaching moment that you had for me in 1994 that continues to resonate in a huge way. This anthology, Resist Much, Obey Little, that Nate Mackey had a hand in editing, that one of my poems is included in, that's an echo of Whitman. And Robert Bly also knew the dynamics of being a man, which, you know, masculinity is under attack because of the toxic testosterone of the people who are running this country right now. But, you know, everybody has within them the opposite gender, and we need to be in touch with that, and we need to be good with that. And Robert Bly was involved in the men's movement that did incredible work for allowing men to become emotionally literate, which is really the key to a lot of our issues right now.
Yeah, I think he was doing work. He was doing work with Mead. I remember, and people were beating drums and running into the woods.
Well, they were, but you know, they were being initiated into manhood, which is something that this culture doesn't do. Mm-hmm. And you know, an indigenous person would understand that urge and say, "Duh, you know, you have to do that." And Bly knew that a long time ago. And, you know, he's very important, not only for his poetry, but for his work with helping men become more emotionally literate.
Well, talking about men becoming more emotionally literate, in Nathaniel Mackey's book, Splain Anthem, he talks about our need to poetize or sing is to talk like a bird. We should get into, like, bird talk. Are you getting into bird talk, Paul?
You know, it's an interesting thing that you mentioned, because it's my understanding that one of Denise Levertov's ancestors could understand the language of birds. And when you hear that, you think shamanism right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that the birds and animals in general really appreciate music. So sometimes when I hear a bird out here, and we're just getting birds coming back because it's getting close to springtime, I'll whistle a Thelonious Monk tune and see what they think about that, like Baya or something like that, or Green Chimneys, and it's a fun experience to have that interplay with the critters like that.
Yeah, I was thinking about also like Eric Dolphy, you know, where people, you know, you get into, are you out there playing with a flute or anything? Are you picking up any instruments to accompany with your work, Paul?
No, I've got a drum. I do play with a flute player, Jim O'Halloran. We're going to do an April 1st thing at a club called the Lake Chad Cafe, which is run by Kenyan people and is part of a historic jazz neighborhood in this town, where Quincy Jones and Ray Charles and a lot of other musicians of local renown played back in the 40s and 50s. Jackson Street. Paul DeBarros wrote a book about the history of jazz in this town. And so I get to do that on April 1st, and it's such a joy to play with incredible musicians like Jim or Evan Flory Barnes or Devon Lewis or other people who, you know, because they're from Seattle, they're not as well known, but I would put them up with any jazz band in the world.
Mm-hmm. You know, I when I think of you, Paul Nelson, I know that you are a very well-read person, and one of the things we try to do on this show from time to time is just introduce our listeners, you know, to new books. You know, we were talking about the regional aspect in terms of our literary world, which sometimes we don't hear about certain authors. Are there any writers that you're very high on right now that you would share with our listeners, like, oh, pick up so-and-so's book?
Yeah, Stephen Collis, once in Blockadia, I think, because of the Kinder Morgan and fighting the oil pipeline, but also because of his lyric sensibility, which is really coming out. He's really one of the headliners that's emerging in this bioregion for our work and our purposes of creating a sense of bioregional community. You know, of course, the Tisch poets in Vancouver, B.C., specifically George Bowring and Daphne Marlett, her new book, Reading Sveva, was about this Italian-Canadian painter whose mother kind of kept her trapped in the house for something like 25 years, but then when her mom passed on, she started painting and is a painter who should be known all over the world. Reading Sveva is the book by Daphne Marlett. Those are two who come to mind. I'm looking around at my stacks of books.
I know you have a stack. But do you have any trips? You have any trips back east? You know, I picked up this the time before Slaughter, and I can't believe that I haven't seen you in like what, 6 years.
I think I was out there to see my daughter when she lived in D.C. about 3 years ago.
Okay, three. Okay, all right. I said that can't be the case. Well, you know, I'm happy that you got up early this morning, Paul Nelson, and was able to join me on the margin. I always admire the things that you're doing. I hope your book of interviews sees the light of day very soon, because it's very, very important. Thank you for being on the margin. My guest today has been Paul Nelson. He is the co-founder of the Northwest Spoken Word Lab, and he's the author of Time Before Slaughter. The show's On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.
9.3. Mayfair Mansions, located in far northeast, is one of the historic neighborhoods of Washington, D.C. Double Nickels Theater is mounting a celebration of the seniors and other members of the neighborhood. Send your stories and remembrances of the first community to be designed by an African-American architect by March 24th to info@doublenickels.org. We may include them in our production to be held on April 8th at Woolly Mammoth Theater. Send your stories to info@doublenickels.org. Nickels is spelled N-I-C-K-E-L-S. This is WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
AFI Africa Fair and Africa World Now Project present the 13th Annual New African Film Festival from March 9th to the 19th at AFI Silver Theater and Culture Center in downtown Silver Spring. This year's festival features 20 films from 14 different countries, showcasing the vibrancy of African filmmaking from all over the continent. Highlights of the festival include the opening night film 76, a political thriller from Nigerian superstar director Uzu Ojukwu, music documentary Mali Blues, Mohammed Bin Atiyah's award-winning feature debut, and returning for its second year, the African Marketplace, where attendees can shop local vendors selling African home goods, clothing, jewelry, books, and art. Explore the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa at the 2017 New African Film Festival. Tickets and full schedule at afi.com/silver. That's afi.com/silver. WPFW, serving 100% of the 99%.
Get on a move to free the Move 9. Supporters of the Move organization is calling for the United States Justice Department to open a civil rights investigation into the almost 4-decade imprisonment of Move political prisoners. Your help and signatures are needed. To sign, go to www.causes.com/campaigns/92454 free the Move 9 to sign the petition. Let's get on the move to free the Move 9. For more info, you can go to www.onamove.com.
Take an audible journey to Cuba with District Timba every Tuesday from 3 to 5 p.m. right here on WPFW 89.3 FM or online at WPFWFM.org. Your host, Mimi Machado Luces. Music curated by DJ Darwin Pena, plus surprise visits from artists, filmmakers, y cubanos de todo parte del mundo. District Timba, Cuba Beyond the Embargo, on your Jazz and Justice Radio.